For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked is doomed. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts always be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. One thing that really used to irritate me as a young reader is that I would go and get a book I was really excited to read at the library, and I would bring it home and I would start to read it, and I'd read like two or three pages at the front of the book, because I'd start just at the beginning of the book, just like anybody does, and I would realize about two or three pages in, what I was reading was not the story that I went to get. In fact, what I was reading was some rambling by somebody put 20 pages of extra text before the story started. And I couldn't figure out why an author would do that, or why a publisher would do this, that they would put this prologue up at the front, because I wanted to get to the story. I wanted to get to the good part. I didn't think there was any benefit for reading these 20 extra pages that they had probably charged for when they had published this book. I thought it was all a scam. And I'll tell you what, some prologues are a scam, but I, over time, started to think, well, I'll go back and read that prologue after I read the story. They did put it in there, and I'm not going to wait or just waste it. Somebody thought this was important. So I'd read the whole story, and then I'd go back and read the prologue. And in doing so, I came to a revelation about something, that my way of consuming the book was actually the way that had been written. That the prologues often are not written first. In fact, the prologue is really the author reminiscing on the process of writing the book. And in that reminiscence, the author has decided, there's some things I really think might be important for you to know as you enter my story that I've crafted for you. They might orient you to the world that they've created, or the characters that they've made, or they might tell you how the story changed in their minds as they started to write it, that they intended to write one story and came out writing another. But regardless of the types of things that they put in the prologue, the point was they had gained some insight or wanted to provide some orientation to this reader of this story that they cared so much about, so that they might get the most that they could out of the story. It was meant to be a tool for the reader to really enjoy. So last week I was sitting in the upper room classroom with Joy and the kids that were in there, and they had been collecting, I don't know how long they've been collecting these, maybe it took them 5 minutes, maybe it took them the whole Sunday school year, but they had a whole list of questions on the board for that they thought the priest should know the answer to, and so I did make up answers for every single one of them. I'm not sure I knew them all, but you know, I did what any good person does when they ask a question. I gave an answer. And one of them was, who wrote the Psalms? And I had to say, well, lots of people wrote the Psalms. In fact, the Psalms is a collection of these songs and prayers and thoughts that people had about their encounters with God, really over a 1,000-year period of time. And so lots of people wrote them. They're written across many different geographies. They're written by people with many different points of view. And so I think about the scribes when I got to Psalm 1 this week, saying, like, if you're the scribe putting this collection together, what do you put at the front of it? What do you put at the front of this massive work of ancient poetry that's going to help the reader get the most that they can of their encounter with it? And they did it. They decided that they would go and pick Psalm 1. Psalm 1, as most scholars will tell you, is by far, these are not arranged chronologically. This is written, it may be, in fact, the tradition is it's the last psalm written with the purpose of allowing those who encounter the Psalms to derive their biggest benefit. So you would think if you're going to do that, this isn't one of these 20-page prologues, this is short. It's one of the shorter psalms in there. And it's got a lot of work to do. It's got a lot of work to do if it is going to allow you to go and encounter songs of thanksgiving, psalms of lament, psalms of wisdom, psalms that are violent, psalms that are loving. How is one little six-verse poem going to put you in the right mode to pray. And so they do it, and they do it in a really innovative way by not innovating at all. In fact, every image that is in the psalm comes from another psalm. In fact, these are the images of the Old Testament. People walking in ways, councils in king's courts, trees by rivers. This is nothing that they would have innovated that way. But the way they're employed is to give the reader a new way of looking at the selection. So the first thing that it does, like any good poem, is it just kind of puts out this contrast of the things that are in the world. Evil and good. It doesn't get any simpler than that. In fact, the topic it takes up is not innovative. The way of the evil and the way of good folks. But it does it in a way that is surprising. In a way that is somewhat subtle. And it starts very much in the very first three action verbs to put the person into the position of prayer through a little story. Blessed or happy is the one who does not walk in the way or counsel of the wicked, who does not stand. I know that our translation has linger. It's terrible. Literally stand. They don't walk. They don't stand. And they don't sit in these places. And if you think about it, what is happening here is in that very first salvo, this very first psalm, you are encouraged to take your body out of the places of the world that are wicked, and you're to put your body in the physical posture of prayer. That you walk, that you stand, and that you sit. And then it says the next thing is the law is there of the Lord is their delight, and they meditate on it day and night. Now, this meditate is also a motion word, though we have lost this. And this is one of these things that when we think about translating words, we have to say, do we translate kind of the abstract meaning of the word, or do we translate the physical, concrete meaning of the word? And this is a place where most translations pick that abstract. But meditate is not, it is not a word that uses just an emotional or intellectual state. The word to meditate is also, and this is important in the next image of the psalm, the word meditate also means to flutter back and forth. It is a physical thing that a body does. And so things do this in nature. In fact, a thing will do it in nature in this very psalm in the very next verse. That you do not walk, and then you sit, and then you've all seen this. If you've seen people at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, how do they pray? They don't pray sitting still. That's right, Sandy, don't they? They meditate. They rock back and forth. That motion is the word that meditate. This motion that is seen by plants and nature, by animals, that is what you do. This psalm is just very specifically saying, if you want to encounter this text, the first thing you have to do is put yourself in the position to enjoy it. And that position is not with the wicked. That position is in the seat of prayer, where you are being moved back and forth by the delight that boils out of you because of your love of the law of the Lord. But then it changes it. And it's as though a cross happens, we could say, in like a movie. So if you go from this image, if you Sandy moving back and forth, it's though we had a close-up on a person in that position that is changed to a tree full of leaves and fruit by a river who is doing the same thing. And now the image of the prayerful one is transformed into the image of the prospering one. A tree that is green and a tree by a river because it doesn't need to move. All of the water that it would ever need is there. It's got the law of the Lord to meditate on. And it's not static. And it's not quiet. Because if you would have been next to one of these folks at the Wailing Wall, they are not quiet. They make lots of noise. And I don't know if you think about this, but trees When the wind is in them, they are not quiet. In fact, you don't see wind. How do you know that wind is happening? Usually, tree nearby being moved and rustled by it. And so the grand image is of this great plant that is stationary and that is fed with water without any movement of its own, and it's moved by the wind that blows through its branches, and it continues to make fruit, and it's evergreen. It never loses its leaves. So these scribes, when they put this up here, want to say, this is how you will be blessed. This is how you will be happy if you encounter these things in a way to rock back and forth and to be nourished by them. They will produce fruit for you. Notice there is no work being done by the prayer other than to be receptive to what's around them. But then it's hard cut now. The tree goes to something that could not be more dissimilar than it. The wicked, on the other hand, are chaff. It means they're waterless. It means the wind does not rustle them and enliven them. It moves them and blows them and sends them flying across the world. They have nothing to hold them down. And they have nothing to nourish them. And they have nothing to offer to any person that would come and visit it the way that tree would by the river. You have the picture of two things you can be when you go through the Psalms. You can be this tree, or you can be this chaff. And then, in its very tidy way, the psalm brings us back to the very first image, which is of a person standing in a council room. In the very first image was that the righteous will not stand. They won't do it. They will choose not to. But now that we have seen the image of the wicked and we're starting to come back out, is the wicked cannot stand in the council of the righteous. They lack the fortitude to be able to do that. The strength that is then implied, that is derived by encountering God and all of the emotions and all of the experiences and all of the ways that people encounter God and then express it in the Psalms, those are the things that make you able to stand with the righteous. And folks that cannot accept that broad variety of these things, it's not that they will not stand, it's that they cannot stand. And then finally, we are back to the image of the road. And the image of the road is this: God knows the road of the righteous, but the way of the wicked, that road, that image that one walks in, the way of the wicked will be lost. It will perish. It will be destroyed. It will be utterly forgotten. It goes nowhere. And so in the closing of this, it is the encouragement that what you are striving for is not a better way of life, is not more prosperity, but what you are striving for is something that lasts. And that can be found in walking to the right place, standing with the right folks, sitting and murmuring, and becoming that tree by the river. But if you refuse those things, if your life is tossed around, if you cannot find the stillness, if you cannot find the delight in all of the varieties and broadness of the ways that God is experienced in these psalms, you'll become untethered and you become lost. So I don't know if the scribes totally like knew. I mean, they certainly have an agenda. There's no doubt about it. But when they put this at the beginning, it is for our aid. It is for us to sit and meditate on day and night, that we might find our delight in the law of the Lord and know that in it we will bear fruit. Amen.